Just to summarize, because this was such a main point and we got into some of the technical details, but stepping back, the key requirement here that shows that this density operator as a representation for our ensemble is good because it's able to properly reproduce the statistics of any measurement we do as described by some arbitrary POVM, just as you'd expect. That it's as if I just took all of the elements of my ensemble and measured them and then weighted them according to the distribution of that ensemble. So it's just what you'd expect. Putting things together in a density operator in that way is sufficient for reproducing the statistics of measurement of that ensemble. Let's talk about some specific mixed states or density operators. Let's think about those of a qubit. So I should add of a qubit, of a two-dimensional quantum system. So here we are trying to figure out a nice geometric representation of all density matrices, all density operators of a qubit. We had a nice geometric picture for all quantum states. Now I'll use the term pure states to describe those vectors in the Hilbert space. Once we fixed the normalization and discarded that overall phase, we found that they were in one-to-one correspondence with the surface of a sphere. So we call that the Bloch sphere. Any point on the surface of that sphere uniquely specifies a quantum state of a two-dimensional system and vice versa. It's great, that representation also extends very naturally to describing mixed states if we extend that Bloch sphere to what we call the Bloch ball, where we fill in that sphere so that we can have states inside it and represent mixed states by vectors with length less than one. And I'll show you how to do that. So perhaps the first thing to recognize is that we're trying to represent a density operator, some operator representing the quantum state of a qubit. That's an operator on a two-dimensional complex vector space. So it can be thought of as a 2x2 complex matrix. It has to be Hermitian in trace one. We can represent any Hermitian matrix in this space of operators using a basis of matrices. And we have a very convenient basis of matrices for a qubit that's provided by the Pauli matrices together with the identity operator. So note that the four operators, the identity on this 2x2 space, and then the Pauli sigma x, Pauli sigma y, and Pauli sigma z form an orthonormal basis. Of operators. Now, what do I mean?
Okay. I was about to say I'd define the inner product between the operators.
Exactly. So, what do I mean when I say an orthonormal basis? I need an inner product. The operator space is naturally endowed with an inner product called the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product, and it's just given by the trace. So let me fix some new notation, which I'm not really going to use anymore today, but you might see this occasionally. Of course, we can represent the Pauli matrices maybe as x is sigma 1, y is sigma 2, z is sigma 3, and sometimes people call the identity sigma 0, so that I can write those as basis elements and write an orthogonality condition. The Hilbert-Schmidt inner product is the trace of the product of the two matrices. They're Hermitian, so I don't have to worry about any adjoints. And these are orthonormal under that inner product. So that's worthwhile checking if you haven't seen that particular property of the Pauli matrices before. And especially the fact that you can include the identity into that list and that they stay orthonormal under this Hilbert-Schmidt inner product. So make sure you check that sometime if you've never seen that identity used. Okay, that means we can take any density operator and express it in its components in the basis of these four operators. These four operators are themselves Hermitian. The space of Hermitian operators is a closed subspace of the space of all complex operators. And since we have a basis of Hermitian operators, we can just use real coefficients to decompose an arbitrary Hermitian operator like the density operator. It's positive, so it has to be Hermitian. And I'll just give you the decomposition, and it'll be an exercise for you guys to check that it works. The identity component is always a half, and we have a vector in three dimensions. So just to be clear, I introduced that four index notation up here, but this is just a three vector, x, y, and z, for the three Pauli matrices. So R is a three vector, and if R is of length less than or equal to 1, that gives a valid density matrix. You can check that it is positive. It has trace 1. All of those Pauli matrices have trace 0. Sigma X, sigma Y, sigma Z are all trace 0. So the only thing that contributes to the trace is the identity component. The trace of the identity is 2, and that's why the this part's fixed. It has to be a half of the identity in order to satisfy the trace 1 condition. These guys are all traceless, so they don't contribute. They don't add anything to that trace. Yeah?
I think trace sigma I, sigma z equals to 2 times the identity.
I think you're right, actually. Thank you for that. Very good point. Thanks for catching that. Trace orthonormal if I were to rescale them appropriately. Okay, so we have trace of rho is equal to 1. And what are the components of that vector? If I was given a density matrix for qubits, I could work out what the components of that vector are just by taking the trace of rho with the sigma operator. And for each of the components, that will give me the component of R. Because of that orthonormality condition. So any vector of length up to 1 specifies a density operator. Any qubit density operator specifies a vector. Okay? There's some steps in there where you'd need to show that one-to-one correspondence. I'll leave that to you guys as an exercise. It's worthwhile to think a bit about what are the corresponding density operators viewed as an ensemble associated with various points on that sphere. So in the center of that sphere, R equals 0 corresponds to rho equals just the identity operator on 2. Sometimes we call that the completely mixed state. Any vector with length R equal to 1 corresponds to a pure state. Rho is equal to some psi. And what I'll leave it to you to show is first that R equals 1. It's not obvious from this condition if its length is 1, but that will give a density operator that is rank 1. It is a projector onto a single state, but it is. You guys can show that step. But also that the corresponding projector viewed as a quantum state for some R of length 1 is a point on a sphere where R is exactly the vector of our original Bloch sphere. So we talked about the Bloch sphere before. We talked about associating quantum states with vectors of length 1. And the nice thing about this formulation is that if you pick a vector of length 1, the corresponding density operator is exactly the pure state density operator representing the pure state with that same vector. That the Bloch sphere picture and this Bloch ball picture match up exactly. Okay, there's a few details in there for you to work out, and I'll leave that as a bit of an exercise. But it's one of those things where you just have to play with it a bit and get used to it. Does anybody have any questions on that? So this is a particularly convenient representation for then any density operator of a single qubit. We can represent them as vectors of length less than or equal to 1. If it's a vector of length equal to 1, that corresponds to a pure state on the surface of that sphere. If it's of length strictly less than 1, that corresponds to a mixed state. It will have rank 2 if it's the vector is strictly less than 1. That means there is at least 2 states in its in that ensemble, in that decomposition. If we're at the center of that sphere, we call that the completely mixed state. The density operator is just proportional to the identity. Any questions with that? Happy with that? You will learn to love the Bloch sphere and the Bloch ball if you haven't already. It is your friend. This will not be the first time when you use the orthonormality of Pauli matrices under this Hilbert-Schmidt inner product. The idea now, as I've mentioned, of thinking of quantum mechanics in its more general sense with mixed states, with POVMs, we'll do the same with operators next week's lecture. Viewing the natural space in which to think of quantum mechanics as occurring as a space of operators on a Hilbert space. It's a very natural one, and you'll get increasingly used to using the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product of operators. That space of operators is also a vector space. It has an inner product. You'll be using that increasingly more. And the fact that the Pauli matrices provide a very natural orthonormal basis, it is like the natural basis to do most of your calculations in. Just because of the convenience of Pauli matrices. Okay, so that will not be the last time you see some of those identities. Okay, so we're getting used to using this density matrix, the idea that we can represent this ensemble by a positive trace 1 operator. You do get the feeling that something's lost when taking that ensemble. So if I give you a list of probabilities and quantum states, I feel like I have all the information about that ensemble. I combine it together into a density operator, and you're like, haven't I lost some information in that process? Well, you have. It's not possible to take a density operator and then say, what is the ensemble that reproduces it?
Except for a pure state, right?
Except for a pure state, yes, thanks for that. For a pure state, there is a unique, there's a unique pure state for every rank 1 density matrix. But in general, it's not possible to reproduce the corresponding ensemble. And you might think that this is a deficiency in that density matrix picture, that by going to the density matrix, yeah, sure, on this slide, we can reproduce the statistics of the Born rule. So we haven't lost too much. But nonetheless, if I can't figure out what the ensemble is, haven't I lost information somehow? It's not a bug, it's a feature. This is just an aspect of the strange interplay of quantum and classical uncertainty that's inherent in quantum mechanics. that that density operator has an ambiguity of mixtures to it. And so first, let me show you some evidence that there is such an ambiguity with an example, and then we'll discuss what it means. So let me take a slice for a qubit of this block ball. Let me just take sort of the XZ plane, a slice through it. Pardon my sloppy diagram. So there's the states 0 and 1 at the top and bottom. I could write them as states or as density matrices. Now let's think of the density matrix, which is a distribution, an ensemble of some qubits in the 0 state and some in the 1 state. And let's say that the relative probabilities are 3/4 chance will be in the 0 state, and 1/4 chance it will be in the 1 state. If I were to figure out what's the vector corresponding to that density matrix in my block sphere, it corresponds to sort of halfway up from the center. I can view that point inside the block ball representing that density operator as, yeah, it's taken 3/4 of the 0 state at the top and combined it with 1/4 of the 1 state at the bottom, and it sort of averages to that point up from the center. It's a nice geometric interpretation of that convex combination, that combination through probabilities of those two states. And so it's very natural to think that, oh, okay, how I should think of that density operator is, yeah, 3/4 of the time it's actually in the state 0. 1/4 of the time it's actually in the state 1, and I just don't know which one it is. It's a valid interpretation, but not a unique one. Let's define two new states, A and B, as follows. These states are not orthogonal to each other. If I were to put, so these are pure states, if I were to put them on a block sphere or convert them into density operators and put them on a block ball, and they'd be at the surface because they're pure, then they would be right here. Here's A. And right over here, this is B. Geometrically, they're on the same horizontal line as that dot point here. And in fact, here's something you could check. Let's take the density matrix, which is an equal probabilistic mixture of half the time I have the A state and half the time I have the B state. And again, I can leave it as a bit of an exercise for you guys. I mean, write out what is this operator as a matrix. Take the outer product of A with itself. Same with B. Add those two things together. You'd find that neither of those operators gives projector on A or projector on B gives a diagonal matrix. But when I sum the two together with equal weight of a half for each, I find that the off-diagonal components cancel. And I get just diagonal elements, 3/4 and 1/4. And I could view that as just an expression of this. So this is a bit concerning. I wanted to think of that density matrix, rho, represented by that point in the block ball, as, well, most of the time, 3/4 of the time I have the 0 state, 1/4 of the time I have the 1 state, I just don't know. There's nothing weird in quantum uncertainty here. It's just classical uncertainty. I just don't know which of the pure states the system is actually in. But surely it must be in one of those pure states. In fact, I can even imagine building a device that prepares, you know, some spin half particle in either the zero state or the one state. And it's got a little random number generator in there that flips a coin, and 3/4 of the time it will prepare the zero state, and 1/4 of the time it'll prepare the one state. Put that all inside a box, call that my preparation, and say, okay, how would I describe this with quantum mechanics? I describe it with the state row, but I know inside that box, it's just preparing zero or one. Okay, someone says, prove to me that inside your box, it's not actually making the state A or B. Also, it's got a little random number generator, but now it's just flipping an unbiased coin, 50-50 chance. So half the time it prepares A, half the time it prepares B. Prove to me, without opening that box, that what you were describing, it really isn't a state zero, or it really isn't a state one, is what's happening. And that my alternative explanation, which is that it really is an A and it really is an B, and I just don't know which one, prove that that's not the case. And you say, okay, well, I just have to devise an experiment that will distinguish the top case from the bottom one. But any experiment, no matter how sophisticated a measurement you devise, it will be describable by a POVM, which will have measurement statistics which are determined entirely just by the state row and not by the choice of ensemble that led to that density operator row. That the density operator row contains all of the information that you can possibly get out of any experiment performed on that system. So that should be concerning, maybe, or exciting. It says that there is no physical way to distinguish your assumption, which is that it really is preparing 0 3/4 of the time, or 1 1/4 of the time. There's no way to physically distinguish that from this alternative decomposition. And in fact, there are many such decompositions of that particular state row. I've just given you two that decomposed it into two states. I can decompose that into 3 or 4 or 10 states, or a continuum of states. There are many possible decompositions for any non-pure state row. The full set of space, there's actually like papers written on what is that full set of such decompositions. It's summed up by the so-called Houston-Joser-Wouters theorem. We won't get into the details, but you know, that's the main point, is that there are many such equivalent decompositions. And so the key thing to remember is that preparations or ensembles with the same row are indistinguishable by any measurement. There is no privileged ensemble. All of them are just as good as each other, and there's no way to experimentally distinguish one ensemble from another that leads to the same row. Okay, good. There's questions.
Sometimes I think that, for example, if the point is not on in the axis, mm-hmm. I have it like shifted to the side, mm-hmm. I won't be able to find an ensemble with only 0 and 1, right?
You can convince yourself that the only ensembles that contain just two elements,
yeah,
and the two elements 0 and 1, they have to lie on the dotted line between them. And in fact, geometrically any two elements on the block's sphere, on the surface, can lead to density matrices only on the line that connects the two. But there's nothing, first of all, that restricts me to just taking two elements in our ensemble or having those elements be orthogonal. So there is no point in the block, inside the block sphere, not on a surface, where you can't provide multiple decompositions, multiple different ensembles that lead to that same density operator.
But I could choose now three terms in my row, and then I could use 0, 1, and another one to describe a point that is shifted, right?
Yep, okay. Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, and still that won't cover all the points. That will just cover, sort of a simplex of points that lie within the triangle. I mean, you can basically take convex combinations of the different pair states in your ensemble that forms a convex set inside the block ball of states that you can make using distributions of that set. The closer I am to the surface, the more the purer I am, the closer I am to a pure state, the more restricted I am in what types of decompositions I can use. Do you have a question?
Yeah. So it would not be possible for indistinguishable ensembles to be orthogonal to each other, right?
Orthogonal to each other in the sense that, if they're indistinguishable, they have the same row, yes. So
orthogonal states are always going to be distinguishable, and we can also see that from just the definition of orthogonality, then we can see, so when states are not going to be orthogonal, then also there's going to be this ambiguity.
Sorry, what was the question?
Just from the way that we define orthogonality, we'd be able to see that when we have states which are not orthogonal, then they're going to be indistinguishable in that way.
Yeah, so it's also worth that. That's a good point, but it's also worthwhile thinking about the ways in which we can decompose this state at the very center. That state here, which was rho is the identity matrix on 2, we can write that as a 50-50 mixture of these two states, 0 and 1. Oh, that's 1. But interestingly, we can also write that as a 50-50 mixture of the states plus and minus, which are also an alternative pair of orthogonal states that lead to the same density matrix at the center of that block sphere. Okay, so it's not even enough to say, oh, there's a privileged ensemble consisting of an orthogonal basis of states of which I can decompose things. That might be the eigenbasis of that density operator, because we can actually have degeneracies in that density matrix, even with a cubic case. If you go to higher dimensional systems, then you can have, obviously much richer degeneracies, and have, even for non-completely mixed states, you can have this ambiguity of mixtures hold even for orthogonal states. Yep?
So you said that you cannot distinguish between the two ensembles without opening the box that prepares your states. So if you open the box and see at your bias coin, say, I look at the bias coin, what was the result of that throw, then you would be able to see what it prepares.
Exactly. Yeah. So if I were to rip open the box and say, oh, I can see I've learned more information about my device, there's a little thing that's flipping a coin, and now I can see what the outcome is. Oh, this time it has prepared the pure state 0. So now I would not describe that system by rho, I would describe that system by the pure state 0. The choice of density matrix depends entirely on what knowledge we have of the system. It is, in a sense, a catalog of all the knowledge we have of our system. what is remarkable about this ambiguity of mixtures is that you would think that I could disentangle, or disentangle is a bad word, I could pull apart the two notions of quantum uncertainty, which I think of as like, oh, it's, you know, that's what physics is imposing on me. Quantum uncertainty is some real property of the system. And my classical uncertainty, I just don't know the outcome of that coin flip. You know, one I really associate with my uncertainty. And the other I associate with, you know, quantum mechanics and therefore a property of the system. And this ambiguity of mixtures is one of many examples that highlights there is no such distinction. That you can't unravel the notion of quantum uncertainty in pure states and classical uncertainty in your knowledge. They get mixed up together in some in some way that can't be then separated. Questions about that? I guarantee you'll wake up in, you know, the middle of the night with questions about that. I mean, I can't distinguish these two. Like, it seems clear to me that there's two distinct physical situations going on there with whether I built a box that inside is preparing that or that. There, you know, I think there's a physical process going on in there that I don't have access to. It's like hidden variables. But you know, somehow I should be able to distinguish through some sort of measurement whether it was the first case or the second. And quantum mechanics says no, even in that very classical picture. Okay, let's keep going. I promised when we started talking about mixed states that there was a motivation in understanding not just how to describe classical uncertainty in quantum states, but how I can talk about, for an entangled state, what is the quantum state of just system A? How do I represent that formally? I should, if you give me a quantum system, I should be able to describe it and make predictions about the outcomes of measurements. If you tell me, oh, that quantum system's entangled with something else that's, you know, in another room, you don't have access to it, don't worry about that. Just keep in mind it's entangled. I should still be able to describe my system and make predictions about the outcomes of measurement. So how would I do that? Okay, so let's say we have two quantum systems. A and B. So there's a joint system. A, B. And imagine a density operator on the joint system, rho AB, so if I knew, you know, I take all that I know about system A and B and I describe it by some density operator, rho AB. It could be a pure state, it could be a mixed state. It could be entangled, it could be a product state. Now I want to ask the question, how do I describe just A? Just A. And here's, I'll give you the answer and then we'll unravel it. The density matrix corresponding to the system A is given by, we're going to define a new operation, which is called the partial trace over system B, rho AB. So this is a new operation. Trace sub B is called the partial trace. Let's define it. I can define, it's going to be a linear map on operators. I can define a linear map by its action, excuse me, on a basis of operators. So let me act on a basis made of product operators, A1, A on A, tensor, B1 on B. Oh, and sorry, I want to have it on a basis, so I should actually consider arbitrary outer products, so A1 and A2, B1 and B2. So these are sort of just arbitrary off-diagonal elements or on-diagonal, B1 could equal B2 and so on, of a product state that forms a basis for all possible density matrices rho AB. Okay? So I'm not working out what is the trace for an entangled state, but I can figure out how it acts on an entangled state through linearity and how it acts on this particular basis. I'll define this to be, well, let's keep system A the same. And now I'm going to take the tensor product, throw it away. This is now just an operator on system A, but I need a coefficient which is given by the trace over system B of B1, and that is just A1, A2. That's an operator on A with a number B2, B1. Okay, and then so we define by that and extend by linearity to the full operator space. So one thing I can see immediately from this is that if I took the partial trace of a rho AB that is in tensor product form, I call it a product state of density operators. If rho AB is just a product, rho A tensor rho B, then this will just be rho A times the trace of, oh, sorry, I'm going to call that sigma. Make it sort of arbitrary, sigma B. And if sigma B is a valid density operator for the second system, it has trace 1. So that's just rho A. OK, so that's good. The way I've defined this partial trace is if I have two systems, and system A is described by rho A, and system B is described by sigma B, and then I forget about system B, and I ask, how do I describe system A? I describe it by rho A. Good. Satisfies that property. We haven't looked at all yet about how it acts on entangled states, but we'll get to that. You might ask, why do we use the partial trace? Why is it the right operation? Well, it is one such that for any POVM on just system A, then the probability of some measurement of, imagine I take my joint system rho AB and just measure on system A with the POVM, so I do nothing on system B, so I act with identity on B. That tells me if I have the joint system and just measure system A, there's the probability of outcomes. That, with my definition of the partial trace, is equal to as if I just took system A, described it by rho A, and measured it alone with rho A given by the partial trace. Again, as with always, we demand a condition of our operations in quantum mechanics that preserves the rules of probability theory. And it's basically all we demand. We were looking for an operation to say, how do I describe a subsystem? Your sole requirement is, well, I want to make sure that whatever operation I have that takes a state on A and B and gives me just a state on A, that I should predict the right outcomes for a measurement on that subsequent description, as if I just had system A. It should equal that if I had the combined system. Yes?
You say that this is the reason why we define row A in that way. Is that the only possibility which satisfies that rule?
Yes. I'm making sure that that's absolutely true. It really is the only rule. I think so.
I seem to recall there's a proof in my
denial. It's true for all operators EM, right?
Yeah.
For any operator EM.
For any POVM. Yeah.
And
so I mean, yeah, then it's absolutely true, because in a sense, this is just, we use the fact that this trace of this product really is a well-defined Hilbert-Schmidt inner product on the space of operators. If this is going to be true for any positive operator EM, then this is basically saying that that's completely enough to completely define what is meant by a density operator on row A. So yes, absolutely true. That's the only way to do it. Okay, so we haven't yet seen how this works if you have an entangled state and how you might actually work it out in practice. So let's have a look at that. Okay, so what about, let's take row AB to be the density operator corresponding to a Bell state. And let me just pick the Bell state psi 0, 0. And I'll remind us all what that state is. That's 1 on root 2, 0, 0, plus 1, 1. What is row A? How do I take the trace over B of this density operator? Well, first of all, how do I write out what is that state as a density operator in the computational basis? I do these partial trace calculations by picking a basis and working out in that basis. Let's pick the computational basis. That state, when written as a density operator in the standard basis, looks like this. We have, that's one of the diagonal elements. We have two off-diagonal elements that look like this. And then we have one more diagonal element. Okay, so how could I practically take the partial trace? Now that I have it written out explicitly, what I can do is just do the operation I would normally do for taking the trace of a system, which is sum over the expectation in an orthonormal basis. But now I do that just for a basis for system B. So I want to sum over 0 and 1 expectation value just on system B. So I keep the state of system A. So this first term, system A, is 0 ket, 0 bra. So that's half 0 on A. And then that's going to be how B gets partial traced for that term. For this one, I have 1 A, 0. And then I have 0, 1. Of course, that's going to go to 0. That's going to go to 0. And this last element is we're going to keep. So I get half 0a plus 1a. And I recognize that. I've seen that before. That's just proportional to the identity operator. That's what we call the completely mixed state. And that should be sort of assuring that I have a system of A and B where I've prepared it in an entangled state. It's all about the correlations of the two systems. We've talked before about how should I interpret that state. Well, you say, I can't tell you what the state of quantum A is without talking about it in relation to quantum B. The system, you know, system A could be in a state zero, but only if B is. And system A could be in a state one, but only if B is. And if I don't know anything about B, then I should say, well, I'm uncertain about what is the state of A. Maybe it's in a state zero. Maybe it's in a state one. I should represent that by an ensemble where I say, I don't know which of those states zero and one it's in. And that's what the completely mixed state represents. So that ensemble comes about, in this case, not from saying, oh, I don't know what's happening in my box. Maybe there's some noisy coin flip or something like that. Now the ensemble is arising, seems like, in a different way. It's because I actually have a pure state, but it's an entangled state of two systems, and I don't know something about how it's correlated with the other system, how it's entangled with the other system. That's the origin of my uncertainty in this case. It's not that I don't know about some coin flip inside my box. It's that I don't know about that other quantum system. But both of them represent lack of knowledge, and I can use the same formalism to describe that. Let's go through a bit of an argument to try to unravel what that means. So let's imagine that this entangled state is actually shared by two parties, Alice and Bob. So Alice has system A, Bob has system B. If Bob were to measure his system B in the Z basis, the basis 0, 1, the eigenbasis of the Pauli Z measurement, he gets an outcome. It could be 0. Imagine he gets that outcome. It could have been 1, and we'd have to work out a separate case. But Bob, Alice and Bob share the system which they describe by an entangled state. Bob chooses to measure his system and imagine he gets the outcome 0, or plus 1, in terms of the eigenvalue of the Pauli Z operator. Now, if Alice measures her system, in the Z basis, looking at that entangled state, I can tell you exactly what's going to happen. She will get 0, or the plus 1 outcome, with certainty. So which description of her quantum state should Alice use? You might say I should use the reduced density matrix for the entangled state, which is half the identity operator on A. Or maybe I should use the fact that it's this pure state, because that is the only unique state which will, when she measures in the Z direction, give that outcome with certainty. One of these descriptions, I argued, is the right one to describe the reduced density matrix, the quantum state of Alice's system. But the other is the one that I said must be used to accurately predict the outcomes as predicted by the Born rule for the measurement that she does. So which one should she use?
Which she knows about Bob measures.
That's exactly the point. What does she know? Say she was told Bob is going to measure his system in the Z basis. How should she describe the system? Well, she doesn't know what he got. He might have got 0, in which case her state's in a state 0. He might have got 1. Her system should be in a state 1. She doesn't know the outcome yet. I should describe it by an ensemble, 50-50 chance of 0 or 1. I'll describe it by the mixed state. Say Bob calls her and says, oh, I did that measurement. I got the outcome 0. Alice changes her description from this completely mixed state where she had uncertainty. She got new information. She now changes her description to this one. Now, you sort of think, well, is that consistent with all possible measurements she could do? If she has the information and updates it to this, and then decides to measure it in a Z basis, she'll get the outcome that she predicts with certainty. No worries. What if she didn't update it? What if she said, oh, I don't know what Bob got. He said something on the phone. I didn't quite hear what he said. Can I still describe the outcomes? Can I still use the Born rule and calculate probabilities? It says, oh, it's 50-50 chance if I measure it in a Z basis, I'm going to get 0 or 1. She measures it, she gets 0. She's like, oh, yeah, that could have happened. I didn't know which one I was going to get, but then I measured it, and that's what I got. So they're completely consistent, whether she has the information, in which case, if she measures the system, she gets what she expects. If she doesn't have the information and describes it by a mixed state, she can measure the system, and it's still consistent with what she had predicted. There's no contradiction there, but you couldn't say which one she would describe for that quantum system, you know, which one's the right answer. You know, if she has the information, she should do this, she'll get her best prediction, but if she doesn't have that information, this is not going to give her anything incorrect or wrong. So that's not very surprising. That can happen in the classical world as well. What description she uses depends on her knowledge. Of Bob's measurement. But it gets a bit weirder. What if instead, if Bob measured in the X basis and gets the plus B outcome, he gets plus 1 for the eigenvalue of the Pauli X operator. Now, Alice is confronted with the same question. Without any information, she describes it as that completely mixed state. If Bob tells her, I measured in the X direction, and I got the plus outcome, you can check for that maximally entangled state. It's not obvious, you have to do a change of basis, but if Bob measures in the X direction and gets the plus outcome, Alice will get the minus outcome with certainty. If she knows Bob measured in the X direction and got that outcome, she should describe it by that state. And that means if she measures it in the X direction, she'll be perfectly anti-correlated with his measurement. If she didn't have that information, she should describe it by this completely mixed state. So that mixture is natural in saying, oh, well, I don't know the outcome of the measurement. Bob measured it in the Z direction. I don't know the outcome. I should be uncertain about it. Oh, he measured in the X direction. I don't know the outcome. I should be uncertain about it. What if she didn't even know what measurement basis he's going to measure it? She doesn't even know yet whether he's going to measure in the X direction or the Z direction. No problem. It's the same density matrix for both. That's where the ambiguity of mixtures helps you. Yeah?
So you're asking the question to, like, for me to describe a system, of a system which someone interacts with without knowing how he interacts. So I'm like describing a system without knowing it's Hamiltonian. How can you describe it at all?
Yeah,
I'm
well,
always going to pick the one I don't know anything. Or
so you, what we want to do is, I mean, that's always possible. You can always say, I don't know anything. But quantum mechanics allows us to do more than that. If you are trying to describe a system which is correlated with something else, you don't know what they're measuring on it, you don't know what outcomes they're getting, you are still able to make predictions about what measurements you can do on your system.
So you are describing two systems which are interacting without knowing how they interact.
So there's no interaction here at all.
Yeah, there is interaction between the, like, if Bob looks at Alice measuring it, then there is interaction between Alice and the system. You call it a measurement because it's a measurement from Alice's perspective. From Bob's perspective, there's just two systems which interact.
So in the operational quantum mechanics as we're describing, we make a clear distinction between objects that are performing measurements, they're observers, they're not described by quantum mechanics, and systems that are described by quantum mechanics.
Why?
Because that's what operational quantum mechanics does. It makes a complete distinction between those two things. Now, you might say, I would like a more fundamental theory that includes
stuff like consciousness, or
I'm not including anything. I'm saying,
how do you define an observer?
Something that performs quantum measurements.
it's just an interaction between two, whether it's a person or a spin, who cares?
So I, you know, everyone agrees with you. You want a fundamental theory that includes quantum mechanics and includes the observers that can perform measurements on quantum mechanics. You want one, but one does not yet exist. We do not have a working theory that predicts everything we know about quantum measurement, including all of the properties of the Born rule, but that does not include some sort of external agency which says, you know, it is a measurement and it will determine an outcome out of a range of possibilities. We do not yet have such a theory. You can apply the rules of quantum mechanics to an observer. We'll go through some of these arguments next week when we talk about things like Wigner's friend. And you can say, okay, from Bob's perspective, he wants to treat Alice as a quantum system and describe her action, her measurement of the system as just some interaction. You'll find that you can get a contradiction with quantum theory, with the quantum theory that I'm presenting. You cannot make those things consistent with what we have about quantum mechanics today. You want a theory that includes measurement, and we don't yet have one. Go out and get one. That's what you're here for. but we do not yet have a theory that incorporates measurement into quantum mechanics. Our theory of quantum mechanics takes measurement out of the Schrödinger equation, out of everything else, and puts it on as a separate axiom. So I feel your pain. It's what we're all here, what we're trying to develop, but we do not yet have such a theory. So we'll get into some of the contradictions with these types of Wigner-Friend's argument next week. Okay, so what I wanted to emphasize here is one of the advantages of this ambiguity of mixtures. The way we can interpret how I can think of this mixed state as being, oh, well, it's an equal uncertain combination of the state 0 and the state 1, or it's an equal uncertain combination of the state plus and the state minus, one corresponding to distinguishable eigenstates of the Z operator, the other corresponding to distinguishable eigenstates of the X operator. That ambiguity of mixtures is just reflecting Alice's uncertainty about Bob's measurement outcome and the basis, what measurement he's doing. Both of these descriptions are compatible with her saying, Bob may have measured half of this entangled state. I don't know what outcome he got. I don't even know what measurement he did yet. He might have measured in the x direction, in which case he's going to collapse my state to plus or minus. He might have measured in a z direction, in which case he's going to collapse my state to 0 or 1. I don't know which of any of those possibilities is going to occur. I'm going to stick with describing my quantum system by this mixed state. And the ambiguity of mixtures means that it is compatible with all of those possibilities, the different outcomes, as well as the different possible measurement directions themselves.
Like you're saying the least that you can say. The mean.
It's the least and the most.
Well, the least and the most.
Yeah. I mean, it's the beauty of this density matrix formulation is it is just exactly quantifying what you can say about the predictions of measurements given the information you have. And it will never let you get caught up in a contradiction about making statements making predictions about experiments that are not going to be borne out by an experiment. Any other questions on that? Let's look at some more technical properties of dealing with entangled states. We're going to introduce something called the Schmidt decomposition. Suppose we have a pure quantum state of a composite system, a joint system. A, B. Yeah. So here's an important technical result. It's a theorem that we're going to prove. Then there exists orthonormal states I, indexed by I for system A. Another set of orthonormal states indexed also by I, sorry, not by J, for system B, such that I can write this joint entangled state, pure state, as a diagonal sum in this basis with coefficients. I'm going to write these as the square root of some positive numbers. So the square, and I'm going to take the positive square root of them. Or I should say non-negative numbers. So they're real, non-negative. That. Sum to 1. Note that the lambda sum to 1, and then it's the square root of lambdas that are the coefficient in that pure state expansion. Okay, so that's sort of compatible with other ways you've described pure quantum states. The coefficients look like the square roots of probabilities. Here we've managed to pick them all to be real and non-negative. Okay, so the key thing here is, I mean, it would have been boring if we had a double sum over index I and j for two different bases. But Here, the point is we have just a single sum. It's sort of like we've jointly diagonalized this entangled state. Yes?
So will there be summing over?
Okay, so it is there. The we have an index set of states, they're orthonormal. They may not form a basis. So we're summing over a range that can not go any greater than the dimension of the smaller of the two Hilbert spaces. If it was a product state, you know, that sum might just have one term. So the number of non-zero components that we sum over, it depends on what the state is, but it's not set by the theorem. Okay, so we're going to prove this, but first a little bit of notation. These guys are called the Schmidt coefficients. This is called the Schmidt decomposition. The number of non-zero lambdas, the number of terms that we have to sum over in the sum, we call the Schmidt rank. So let's prove this. So we're going to do a proof just for when the two quantum systems are of equal dimension. It's pretty easy to extend a proof when they are not. So let's pick any bases for the two quantum systems. So we'll label the bases, orthonormal bases, J of A and K of B. So these are not these vectors I. These are now some just arbitrary basis that we're picking for our two quantum systems. And we know that we can write any state in this basis of product states. So there'll be a double sum here. This is the thing that's sort of boring. Anything can be, of course, written in this double sum. And then what we want to do is a singular value decomposition on this matrix of coefficients A. Who's seen the singular value decomposition before? About half of you. It's very useful in linear algebra. The singular value decomposition basically for finite dimensional matrices lets you write an arbitrary matrix in terms of a diagonal matrix and then unitary matrices, different unitary matrices on each side. So this guy is diagonal. And in particular, it's non-negative. And these guys are unitaries. And that singular value decomposition basically gives us our proof. We define IA to be the states given in this arbitrary basis J we chose for system A, transformed by this unitary from the SVD. And we choose get my indices in the right order here. Same thing for system B. And we choose these Schmidt coefficients to be given by the diagonal elements of that diagonal matrix, which are real and non-negative. Okay, now these guys turn out, each of them separately, the IAs and the IBs turn out to be orthonormal due to unitarity of U and V, right? We had an orthonormal basis. We've applied unitaries to give a new set of vectors, I and IA and IB. Okay, and then with that, okay, so that basically proves the theorem. With that, what's the use of this Schmidt decomposition? It makes it particularly easy when you have a pure entangled state expressed in terms of the Schmidt decomposition to work out what are the reduced density matrices on system A and system B. The partial trace of rho AB for this pure state is given by, now, so it's sum over lambda, that should be sum over I. That the vectors I are the eigenbasis of the reduced density matrix rho A, and lambda I's are the eigenvalues. And for rho B, it's the same thing. Now it's the partial trace over A of rho AB. This is equal to the sum over I lambda I B I. So now it has eigenvectors IB. It has the same eigenvalues as rho A does. So when I take a pure entangled state and look at the reduced density matrices for each, the eigenbases are set by these special orthonormal states in this Schmidt decomposition. They're, of course, different. If the systems are, they're different because they're different systems. But the eigenvalues for both of those reduced density matrices are the same eigenvalues, and they're given by those Schmidt coefficients from that decomposition. So if you have a entangled state expressed in a Schmidt decomposition, it is very easy to work out local properties using this relationship at the bottom. Yeah?
Is the sum of the lambdas a measure of, oh no, not the sum of the lambdas. It's like the rank, the Schmidt rank or something like that, the measure of entanglement or something?
Yeah, it is. Schmidt rank is quite commonly used as, I should say, a measure of entanglement. It has a bunch of features which say it's not necessarily a very good way of quantifying entanglement. For one, it sort of just takes integer values and so on, and it doesn't necessarily reflect how much entanglement is in a system by a bunch of the standard measures that we have. But it is a good indicator. If you have Schmidt rank of 1, then it's a product state. There's no entanglement. As soon as you have a Schmidt rank greater than 1, it says there is entanglement in the system. And there's many ways in which looking just at something like the Schmidt rank gives you a bit of a proxy to how much entanglement is in a system. It's particularly true when people study, say, for example, the ground states of quantum many-body systems. You can take a bipartition of the system and do a Schmidt decomposition of it, and then you can use that Schmidt rank of that of the bipartition of the system as a proxy for how much entanglement is in that state. That's a common thing to be done. There's another thing that's useful with this sort of idea of a Schmidt decomposition. It's almost the reverse. The notion of purifications. Let's say I'm given, for some system A mixed state, and let's find an orthonormal or an orthogonal decomposition . Let's say I've just chosen one, no, that should be PI. Let's say I've just chosen one particular ensemble to represent that density matrix. That could be the situation we were describing before. I have a system, a box that's producing spin states, maybe up, maybe down, say 3/4 up, 1/4 down. I don't know which. I'm just given a density matrix describing that system. It could have come about from a classical ensemble. But it makes sense for me to ask, well, maybe this density matrix is actually the reduced density matrix of an entangled state. Can I imagine an entangled state for which rho AB, maybe even a pure entangled state, psi of AB, for which its reduced density matrix on A is rho A? Doesn't matter if I came up with this through this idea of saying that it's classical uncertainty. Can I imagine that there's an entangled state for which this is the reduced density matrix? Well, the answer is yes. We can always do that. Introduce a new system. We'll call it R instead of B here, to be just sort of some reference. And choose any R equals the rank of rho A, orthogonal states for the system. So how big does that system be? Need to be as big as I want, and I just need to pick a R states. But it's most natural to just say, oh, well, I'm trying to find, you know, just a hypothetical reference system. Let me just pick one of dimension R, given by whatever the rank is of rho A, the number of non-zero probabilities in that decomposition. Okay, then here's a purification. Just from what I know about the Schmidt decomposition, this satisfies, and we've sort of proved it on the last slide, that the partial trace over R of rho AR is equal to, and maybe I'll be more explicit here, that rho AR is the density matrix corresponding to the projector onto psi AR. The partial trace over R of that is rho A. So it's like I found the quantum state whose Schmidt decomposition is the one where the states for system A are my particular ensemble, and the Schmidt coefficients are given by the probabilities of that ensemble.
Is there any ambiguity?
Yes. So different choices of orthogonal states for system R can lead to equivalent, well, I should say, not equivalent, I mean alternative purifications. So different choices of basis on R is equivalent to a unitary U on R. So I can instead define some different basis, and then I have this guy and this other alternative purification, psi prime on AR, defined by identity on A, U on R of psi AR. That's just changing the basis of system R with some unitary. They're different purifications. Any questions on that? Okay, we're getting on in time. How many people have gone through the details of quantum teleportation? Small number. Basically, I'm wondering whether we should spend 15 minutes on it now or leave it till Monday. Who's tired? Who's really keen on hearing about quantum teleportation right now? I think fatigue wins. How about we take a pause there, and that means we won't have to rush through quantum teleportation. It's very simple mathematically. I could present it in 10 minutes, but I think there's enough interesting aspects of it that we can discuss. In particular, in trying to understand this idea of ambiguity of mixtures, what, you know, quantum state in terms of a mixed state should I assign to a given quantum system depending on the information I have, really sort of comes to light in that example of quantum teleportation. So if you want to jump the gun, you can read the section in Nielsen and Chuang on teleportation before Monday's lecture. And we're also going to go through Bell inequalities and EPR and a bit of quantum spookiness. So have a good weekend. I'll see you Monday.